Welcome to the JP Morgan Weekender. I'm Bruce Kasman, and with me from London is Joe Lupton. How you doing, Joe? How's the weather?
Hey, Bruce. It's been a glorious time here in London after what I understand was a pretty miserable winter. So I brought the spring weather, flowers are blossoming, and pub life is active.
I'm glad to see you've kind of got a taste of that. Okay, so let's jump into it. There's a lot of different things going on this week. Obviously, central banks all over the place, data, which is important. I think both the China and the PMI data are worth talking about. But let me kind of put a little frame on what I'm thinking about right now. I think one thing I'm thinking about is this idea of how central banks, how we as economists, forecasters, markets are kind of struggling to think about where normal settles here. Right. We've been, you know, through 2020, 21, 22 into 23. We're all kind of recognizing we're going through very unusual times. But there's a sense right now that things are returning to normal. And that's in some ways the way central banks are talking to us. And the idea is how normal kind of settles out. And there's some things which people are thinking maybe we're getting some positive dynamics, particularly we talk about the U.S. from the supply side point of view. Yeah. There's questions about, you know, where neutral policy rates are. And I think, of course, one of the underlying themes this week is this idea, I think, that you get from Powell, that he's feeling pretty good that we're getting back to a normal that looks, you know, not much different than what it did in the past, if anything, mm-hmm. better because of the supply side problems. There's also the issue of diversity. And I think diversity cuts a few different ways. One is, and we should probably hit this point, is the idea that we're actually feeling there's a somewhat broadening base of global growth, which does reflect the narrowing gaps between manufacturing and services and between Western Europe and the US at least. And you know, we should talk about how well the data is tracking that. But the diversity is also there in the central bank community. And I think one thing that is important here is to kind of think about how much the lead of the Fed, which does look like it's getting ready to ease, drives things versus more idiosyncratic domestic conditions. And there were some central banks which surprised in a hawkish way this week. I wouldn't put the BOJ in that camp, even though we hadn't been expecting the rate move to this week. But certainly you had Taiwan surprised to the upside, and you've had a couple of other central banks, you know, surprise either by not moving. Or if we're going to bring Turkey into the conversation by moving a lot earlier than we expected. So there's a lot I just threw at you, and I'm not suggesting you pick up exactly there, but you've been talking to clients in London. So why don't you kind of start by giving me your kind of focus here, what you want to, you know, highlight?
Well, I mean, I think the framework that you talked about up front about the return to normal, I think that is actually resonating in a way that clients are beginning to talk more, or I would say, in addition to talking about when rate cutting cycles start and how much we can go in the initial pass here this year, that the issue of where things settle as we get into 25 is becoming more of a topic, particularly when you start thinking about soft landings and you look to 95 and how much the Fed could actually cut during that episode. If that's the playbook that you have, can we be in a new world where, you know, the Fed and frankly other central banks can do a gradual unwind of this, of these very tight policies? And I guess I would bring the framework I've been using for quite some time into talk about this normalization that you're talking about, right? I've always said that what we got last year was less about a kind of central bank induced recession, which of course never ended up happening, but was much more about this kind of reversal of a lot of the supply shocks and the supply curve shifting out, and you had falling inflation and stronger growth. And then the question that we're facing right now is, when that dust settles on all of that normalization and strong growth and the transitory supports last year, are you going to settle with inflation at 3%, or are you going to settle with inflation that gets back to 2%? And to your point, I think the Fed is believing that we are on a path back to getting back to normal, if you will, in what I would call mid-cycle, aligning you know, very late cycle rates back to mid cycle fundamentals, getting rates down. And the central determinant factor of that is going to be if you can get inflation back to something that's mid cycle. And I just think it's still a very open question. Powell and company seem very optimistic, well, and I think tone deaf in my opinion, but nonetheless, they could end up be right on this potential normalization.
Yeah, I think if you listen to Powell's press conference, he was quite optimistic, although obviously hit all the notes on the Fed having to be cautious here and somewhat mindful of the data. But he pretty much was dismissive of the first 2 months' surprises to the upside. He was particularly dismissive of the other side of here, is if the Fed, and this gets to become a pretty important point, if the Fed is thinking things are going to normal and it's signaling to us that it's going to ease policy along that lines, then that sends a very strong message to markets, which to some degree alters the way financial conditions are set up.
Well, that was by far the most surprising aspect of the, at least Powell's comments. And frankly, it's something he did similar in December, which I've said on this call, I thought was a mistake. I had assumed Powell woke up the next day and probably said that was a mistake when he didn't really recognize the easing in financial conditions from the November meeting to the December meeting. And of course, you had a whole string of speeches afterwards that seemed to be trying to clean that up. And this
actually, they
like-
didn't. They didn't. All they did was clean up the guidance towards March. They never backed off of the statements about financial conditions. They've never.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I think to the so yeah, I take your point.
And in January, and the clean line from December to January now is that Powell continues to think monetary stances are quite restrictive and are continuing
yes.
to weigh
so
on
growth. So from Powell's standpoint, I definitely agree, and he really believes this. In fact, I'm beginning to wonder how much Powell is being distanced by other people on the committee. I'm kind of curious to see what speeches are going to be like after this.
We should get into the diversity point. And diversity, as I mentioned up front, was mostly about the behavior of central banks across the world. But in the Fed right now, you've got 11 people who want three or more, really almost all of them want three rate cuts
right.
this year. And you got 10 folks who want two or less. So there is a divide there. I think one of the interesting questions is, A, of course, what the data is going to do to that divide. But let's just assume that that divide stays pretty much in place. To what degree is Powell going to drive decisions? Powell, I think, as a chair, has not been one that I can recall really driving decisions through his executive power as chair. But as we move towards the June meeting, the data may decide the outcome. But if we were sitting here today, it would be a pretty strong debate in the committee. And I think we would be biased, of course, for Powell's view being the dominant one.
Well,
but he would
I
have
actually,
to exert some
yeah,
control to do that.
I actually think if you had the debate today, well, they did have the debate and they didn't cut. So I actually think the first thing you said is right. It's going to all be data determined. As much as I was kind of surprised by the kind of what I would call tone deaf, you know, response to the high inflation prints, at least not maybe hitting that more forcefully as a reminder that we're not mission accomplished yet. And he could have been a little more forceful on that instead of as dismissive about it. Being as agnostic as he was on financial conditions, all those things surprised me. I think it's very prospective. It's this kind of high hopes for low rates, right? That's what they have. And I don't doubt their resolve. I think if you get to the June and you're printing inflation prints, in fact, I would say if you get, you know, March, April CPI prints like Jan, Feb, I think it's done.
But March, April by Jan, Feb would be a huge surprise. We get down
right.
to the point of what if March, April on core PCE is like 0.24, which is basically still a 3% run rate. I mean, the last couple of
right.
months on core PCE has been running, CPI has been running over 4.
Right.
So annualized. So let's say we
right.
settle down to something which is closer to 3, and we settle down to something which is closer to 3 on core PCE. You think
yeah.
they don't go?
Yeah, I do. And that's that kind of sufficiency condition I've been getting. If
so
you're
you
down
to
2.5, they definitely will cut.
Are you saying you think you need to have clean 0.2s?
Yeah.
All else equal.
Yeah. Or Bruce, I think you can get your kind of 2.3s, 2.4s,
0.23s, 0.24s.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. And you get a labor market that is cooling more materially, I think then they can go, right? Then it becomes more of a conditional type.
So I guess I've got a more, I got a more dovish read on the reaction function. I'm feeling from Powell a message that says, hey, I want to go. Sure, the data can stop me, but the bar is pretty high here for the data to stop me. I think it's higher than a 0.23, 0.24 core PC CPI profile in the next couple of months. I mean, obviously we can get into,
well, I mean, if that were the case, right. So
but I don't, like, my point is, I think they want to go, and I'm not even going to exclude some underlying political pressure in that motivation. But I don't think they're going to go a lot in that environment. I think if we're running, as I would expect, those kind of numbers on core CPI through the year, which are consistent with something close to 3% on an annualized basis, I think they can go once or twice, but I don't think they can go as the market
if you're getting stuck above 3%, a full percentage point above your target. How could you, if you're a hawk at the table, like, convince me?
Well, let's just keep in mind the year ago numbers are going to be 2.5, even a touch below it by the time we get to the June meeting.
But you're going
to
have 6 months running above 3%.
You're going to have six months running above 3%. But again, we're talking fine differences here. But the first 2 months we're front loading it, and you're going to be settling into something, you know, again, 0.23 is like 2.8, 2.9 on an annualized basis. And I think at that point, if you're getting continued messages that wage inflation, there's a lot of other things in the mix.
Well, that's what I said. I think when you're between 2.5 and 3, I think that you have to start looking at the other.
But if I threw into that, Bruce,
let's take your 2.8, and then I said payrolls are still running 250,000, and ECI looks like it's getting stuck around 4%.
Where's the unemployment rate? If the unemployment rate's not moving down, then you know you don't. I think what the Fed has basically been doing.
Right,
and perhaps rightfully so, is saying if we get strong job growth, but we're getting an unemployment rate that's stable to up, we're not going to really be worried about that. And I think that's actually appropriate,
right,
from a current
right.
reading. What you want to extrapolate going forward is another issue.
Yeah,
so,
well, that's the last thing.
But
yeah,
whatever. Let's at least agree on this. Whatever your thought versus my thought in terms of how the reaction function is different. Powell was more dovish than we would have expected.
Oh yeah, but
okay.
So my distinction is that he came across more dovish, but I don't question the resolve that when push comes to shove, by the middle of the year they'll decide to pause if they feel like they haven't made sufficient progress.
So,
and then I would go one step further and say, even if they do have this motivation to start, that you would get a lot less cutting.
Well, that's
in
been
25.
That's been my view all along. It's not so much that they are going to have a great risk of not starting, but that they don't have that much runway to go if we're right that core inflation stays sticky and the economy continues to deliver. I think they want to ease. I think they probably can ease a little bit. I don't have any big problem with them starting and then not doing a lot. And then possibly, you know, one thing people sometimes lose sight of.
And arguably that was 95.
That's what I was just going to say. The last two economic cycles starting in 2000, the Fed goes up, the economy goes down, the Fed goes down. In the two cycles before that, which were the two soft landings of recent memories, the 80s and 90s, the Fed went up, went down, went up, went down, and went up in all each of those two cycles. So I'm not going through the timetable on all of them. So it's not unusual. It wasn't, as you know, in 95, the Fed, 95, 96, the Fed eases, but then it starts tightening in 97 and gets short-circuited by the Asian crisis and LTCM.
Yeah.
It eases again and then has to restart. And the terminal rate actually at the end of the cycle is above where they got to when they finished the tightening cycle in 94 into 95.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not unusual phenomenon from a historical perspective. There's nothing wrong with those cycles in terms of Fed. It would be wrong to say the Fed made a mistake, because in the 90s and the 80s, the Fed engineered, after its initial hiking cycle, five more plus years of economic growth. Those are soft landings. Those are good events in terms of the dynamics. So to have the Fed move a little bit and then have to reverse, that's perfectly fine. And I think there's an argument for the Fed being, kind of really wanting to ease here a little bit, be able to do a little bit, but not do a lot. And God knows where we'll be in 25. We're going to be
right. My concern and what
one thing
what's
we know in 25 is you and I are still not going to have any hair on our head. I think that's the one thing we can be very confident about.
I was going to say there's one area where there isn't a lot of diversity.
So, but let's leave the Fed because we're gonna obsess over the Fed. But this was a week of the BOJ. This is a week of China data. This is a week of PMI.
Of the SMB,
Taiwan. You know, pick what you want, Joe. There's a whole bunch of other things here worth talking about. So pick what you want to go to now.
Well, I mean, I
think
guess
you're
going to
pick PMIs because you're.
I was just going to say. I mean, we don't have to dwell on it, but of course the. Getting further confirmation of the momentum lift in the surveys, I think is encouraging, both from the manufacturing side and from the services side. You know, echoing the diversity point, I think there were a range of differing outcomes, but overall, you know, composite PMI in Europe moving up is probably one of the more important ones to keep seeing because that was a weak link of an important economy. And so, you know, I actually kind of feel like the Europe is an interesting story where there's probably some upside on the demand side of the equation in terms of a consumer that does a bit better here. The PMIs are signaling something like that. You've got strong employment growth, wage inflation, you've got falling price inflation. So real incomes are up, balance sheets are healthy. All of that says, oh, maybe you could get surprised to the upside here. However, in contrast to the US, where you have a supply side that's kind of meeting that growth, supply in Europe, I think, is potentially a concern. And if you put those two together, maybe inflation doesn't quite come down as much, and maybe that starts to question.
Or maybe
ECB's
we have a
ability.
Reverse Say's law. Maybe demand generates its own supply.
Demand creates its own productivity.
I mean, there is. I think the productivity.
I think there is that. Absolutely.
Some of that gap in Europe is, but I think the interesting. First of all, I totally agree with the way you're reading the data there, and I think we should recognize that there is some decent upside risk even to our forecast, which we're kind of gradually grinding to 1% growth in Europe. And I would also just say as an aside, I think it's a couple of months early, but I think the Japanese consumer is going to kick in here too, especially when my wife gets to Tokyo in April. That's going to help a lot. But I think the story about European inflation is I think supply has been weak and demand has been really weak. And it's perfectly reasonable to say, okay, now demand picks up and that's an added inflationary impulse. But if you're asking me which economy I think has the best chance of getting, of the majors, of getting inflation back to target in the next 6 to 12 months, I'd probably pick the euro area, certainly over the Fed, the US and the UK. I mean, there's some of the smaller countries.
I don't know, Bruce, because I believe in the supply stuff from the US. And moreover, I mean, you are seeing wages come down and you've got the quits rate, which is now lower than it was before the pandemic. I can see the Goldilocks story in the US easier than I can in Europe.
Okay. Well, I think a problem with the Goldilocks story in Europe is that you've created such a huge shortfall on growth that even if you had decent growth here for the next year, you're going to still look at this outcome as pretty disappointing. 1% growth in Europe is not a recovery of all of the losses. But what I'm talking now specifically about is who's got the best chance to get core inflation to 2% over the next 12
months. I know,
and
that's what I'm saying. And I think the structural supply side story is a bit more questionable in Europe than it is in the US.
I know, and I'm probably putting more weight on demand than supply. I think wage inflation in the US is coming down, but it's not going to come down enough. We'll see what the next set of wage data deliver. I mean, I think inflation is going to stay sticky in the US, but we'll see how that plays itself out. Let's talk BOJ for a minute. We should at least give a little bit of attention to Asia with BOJ and China data. So let's start with the BOJ. I think what's interesting is our guys had expected them to hold off and they didn't. They sent very dovish guidance. And we actually raised our sights for policy rates over the next 12 months. We think they're going to get up to somewhere like 0.75, even close to one by the middle of next year. Mm-hmm. So any thoughts from you on that? I'm definitely on board on that. If you take a view that the world is still doing okay, I think Japan will do fine. I think the pressures coming from the currency, coming from the inflation picture there is going to make the BOJ do somewhat more. It's not going to be a repeat of the Fed and ECB in 2022, but it's going to be more than I think markets are currently pricing in. What's your thoughts there?
Well, yeah, I mean, if it's almost, speaking of normalization, it's almost like the BOJ has a faith that they're kind of returning to this kind of more normal world of 2% inflation and 0 to 1% real neutral rates, and they think they're potentially on that path. And Ueda kind of made some comments that were kind of along those lines, which I think has a, I guess I would say, a bit of an optimism in it. Maybe I'd still a little skeptical. I think part of the Japan story is a belief in some of the structural reforms that we're finally seeing the long lags of Abenomics on corporate governance reform and these types of things take place. Having been there recently, I think the views on that are very mixed. Some people believing that it's true, other people believing it's more window dressing. So I guess on balance, I'm still a little skeptical of that, of this kind of return to normalcy in Japan.
Okay. And then I guess the final thing, let's just sort of spend a moment on China data. We raised our GDP forecast sequential for the first quarter, a percentage point or so up to 6.6. But we still have the economy kind of grinding towards a 4% growth rate as we go through the rest of the year. The question is, do we take this signal from what was pretty strong reports more seriously? Do we think that China is just going to continue to surprise the upside, or is this just a bit of a flash in the pan?
I would lean towards flash in the pan. I mean, I think you've got the three big drivers of growth in traditionally real estate, public sector, infrastructure investment, and exports. You know, real estate's in free fall, and that's not turning around anytime quickly. You've got public sector infrastructure investment, and a lot of the policy supports, I think, has given you that near-term lift, but that probably has a kind of a time limit on it. And then exports, I don't know. Like, I don't know if that's going to continue to be as big of a driver as what we've gotten in the recent past. And so that leaves this kind of domestic economy, which has been weak for really the past couple years. And you got a little bit of a reopening bounce, but things stalled late last year. And then this data that we just got, that's where I think the surprise really came. It was a retail sales number that was stronger than expected. It was kind of a return of private fixed asset investment, which had been dead in the water for like 2.5 years. But I mean, I don't want to get in the weeds on the kind of believing or not believing the data, but there are some funny things in the data, the SA compared to the NSA data. The GDP deflator is still very weak, suggesting corporate profitability is weak. And so where's the enthusiasm coming for fixed asset investment? So that path you laid out, Bruce, of kind of near-term strength, not wanting to extrapolate the signal of it and expecting things to slow towards the second half of the year, that's still my baseline.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. Although I think we might carry a little more strength through the middle part of this year, in which case it does kind of feed the broader story of growth outside the U.S. It looks like the first quarter, by the way, will be the first quarter in a while where growth outside the U.S. is actually stronger than in the U.S., which is an interesting swing. We've been running 3 or 4 quarters straight where the U.S. has outperformed the world. So that's an interesting swing. And I think hopefully we're right that the dynamics of the surveys are signaling both Western European and manufacturing sector performance is doing better. I'm feeling comfortable with those views. We obviously still need to see, as you will well point out, the hard activity data haven't yet kicked in a way that kind of confirms that. But
yeah, I mean, the PMI surveys are pointing in the right direction. But yeah, manufacturing is looking pretty darn weak at the start of the year. So
yeah. So we'll see. So let's leave it on that bright note. And I know you've got to go to the airport flying back. And so I'll
see you next week.
See you next week. And hopefully we can continue the conversation. Next week, we're going to do this on Thursday. It will be an early week because of the Good Friday holiday. So take care, everybody.